Someone always finds me.
The swamp is rotting from the inside out, and the stench is getting impossible to ignore.
Yes, I know, Captain Stern. Never did there live a kinder, more generous man.
See?
Unless maybe the preschooler's prostitute ring. Huh?
A longtime Justice Department employee, Timothy Parsons, busted and charged with child pornography possession and distribution. The very agency that's supposed to hunt down these monsters now caught harboring one of their own. Then the New York Times dropped a bombshell on Rhode Island priests abusing hundreds of kids over 75 years with the church, shuffling predators like deck chairs on the Titanic while covering it all up.
The public deserves to know the truth, in my view, and they deserve to know it as a complete story, not a series of short stories that are told over time or over decades as priests are charged or as the media takes a particular interest over a certain period of time. The public deserves to know the whole story from 1950 to 2026, to see it all in its raw emotion and horror and impact.
Piling on, the cartel's black book of child buyers, allegedly kept by El Mencho himself, reportedly packed with 220 names of global power players, including some right here in the United States, scumbags placing custom orders for trafficked kids, complete with specific ages and twisted preferences.
The cartel leader El Mencho, who was just killed, had a list of all the different world leaders that were on it and who was trying to get children, because the drug traffickers make more money at trafficking children, and he has a list of world leaders and powerful people who are asking for certain kids and ages and types, and that list is what they're trying to protect right now.
And not to be outdone, the Uniparty, Congress itself, the deep state global elite filth is protecting their own while the kids pay the price.
I just think it's really disgusting how this institution protects itself, because y'all just half of them voted to send this stuff to House Ethics, where you know it's going to die. We know that members of Congress are using taxpayer dollars to pay off sexual harassment. We just had a member of Congress literally sexually harass a woman that then lit herself on fire, and you guys all protected him. You guys all protected my own side, your side. And so if you guys want to talk about victims, if you want to go out and virtue signal, and then you guys are going to kill her stuff on the floor and then try to pass. Yeah, of course, we should subpoena all of this stuff. But just, I'm not going to sit here and play games. I think it's a complete fraud. I think that's why the American people hate us. I think the midterms are coming up and everyone should go on record for this. And I hope that members are exposed for this. I hope it goes back, I think, to the 70s, because it's wrong that it's happening. It's wrong that we cover up for it. It's wrong that we can't censor our own side because people are busy making deals because you guys don't want to censor your side. It's a deal that's been cut. People hate us for it. So yeah, I support it.
You know, Congress has paid over $17 million in hush money for sexual misconduct inside of the offices in these buildings. And what's more is that was taxpayer money, right? The allegation is that President Trump paid $130,000 of his own money. But here in Congress, we have, there may be some on this dais. I mean, I'm for turning loose all of these records. Who in here has had the taxpayer pay for their sexual misconduct charges, the hush money? I bet there's some over there. There may be some over here. I don't know, but I do know it's taxpayer money, and I do know not a single penny of it has been turned in as a campaign finance expense.
From DOJ insiders to cartel traffickers to Capitol Hill payoffs, the pattern screams one thing into the noonday sun. The powerful shield the predators because too many of them are the predators themselves.
How do we do it to where we hold people accountable but still keep the system from collapsing, as you talked about earlier?
Let the system collapse. A system run by twisted power pedos is no system at all.
He's nothing but a low-down, double-dealing, backstabbing, larcenous, perverted worm. Hanging's too good for him. Burning's too good for him. He should be torn into little bits and pieces and buried alive.
John Bound, reporting for InfoWars.
Oh.
The entire world is racing into the fourth turning and the greatest quickening our species has seen in 10,000 years of recorded history. You know you're in a war, right? And it's a declared war. The globals have declared war on Team Humanity. They've declared war on the God that made us. It is not incredible. It is not heroic. It is not amazing to fight this. It is survival. This is the priority. This is the real world. This is game time. This is the crossroads of human destiny right now. Right now. And I see a bunch of other people not realizing how desperate the situation is. We need maximum urgency. We're up against the most evil people the world's ever seen. Don't you understand that? I don't want anybody to go out and be physically violent. I want you to kill with truth. Kill with your will. Kill, kill, kill their lies.
Dismantling the globalist agenda hour by hour. This is The War Room with Harrison Smith.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the last hour of The War Room, InfoWars.com banned at .video. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Joining me today is Andrew F. Branca. You can follow him on X at The Branca Show and on YouTube at The Branca Show. That's B-R-A-N-C-A, The Branca Show. He's an attorney. He provides pro-America, pro-Constitution, pro-Western civilization, political and legal analysis. He doesn't take himself too seriously either, which you need in these troubled times, because otherwise you'll go insane. Thanks for joining me once again, Mr. Branca.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, you know, where do we even go? Where do we start? What do we say about this? You do what I do. You deliver the news and you deliver analysis and interpretation and sort of provide context that people might not know. And at this point, it's like, what is there even to say about the Iran war that is not self-evident? You know, are you feeling like I am, that it's almost hard to cover this because it's just so absurd? It's like, I don't even know how to explain it. Do you understand what I mean?
Well, I mean, in one sense, there's a lot going on, right? So there's a lot of tactical stuff going on. So there's plenty to talk about. In another sense, though, I have to admit, it feels like one small puzzle piece in a very large puzzle that Trump, and only Trump, could do this, is putting together. It's almost an experience like watching one of these. If you ever see one of these painters who they paint the image upside down, or they paint it in reverse and then they flip the palette and suddenly you recognize what it was they were painting. That's what it is with Trump. All these steps he's taking, if he had a greater overarching 5D chess plan to completely castrate China, it would look exactly like this, like what he's doing. Yet you don't see it at each step in the process. It looks like, all right, well, we grab Maduro out of Venezuela. We're doing this thing in Iran. We've got control of the Strait of Hormuz. He's going to set up an insurance, maritime insurance entity to secure effective American control of merchant marines all over the planet. And of course, China has no oil. It has to import all its oil, much of its resources. It's like a noose is being tightened around China's neck in a way that direct combat could never have neutralized them.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And I've heard that. I don't know how, like, if that's intended, if that's because you do get like very varied interpretation of what's going on, where half the people, and I admit I'm on the side of just like, I don't think he knows what the hell he's doing. I think this was a total debacle. But then you've got the other side going, nope, he's doing this, this is all systematic, this is brilliant, he's totally, you know, beating the globalists. So do you land more on that former side? I mean, do you think that what's happening here is part of a 5D chess sort of operation?
Well, I mean, I'm a lawyer by nature, right? So I look to the evidence and I try to see where the evidence will lead me. I'm not in Trump's inner circle. He doesn't explain to me what he's trying to do. Maybe this is all coincidence. But if he had a greater overarching strategy to neutralize China as a national threat to the United States, would it look much different than this?
Well, to me, I've always looked at it from China's point. Like, if I'm looking at from China's point of view, China, I'm thinking, is just watching America kind of disintegrate. Like, we're slipping in a lot of ways. We're not exactly the competitor that we once were. And if I was China, I'd just sort of like play it cool, just keep, you know, everything operating. Like, if I was China, I wouldn't try to like go invade Taiwan, because the last thing I would want would be a conflict with America. Sounds like maybe you have a different interpretation, because it seems to me like China would be getting involved more if this was hurting them, wouldn't they?
Well, I think Trump is creating a situation in which China cannot invade Taiwan, because they couldn't accept the consequences. You know, you've probably heard Pete Hegseth and others in the administration saying, Marco Rubio saying, hey, we had to attack Iran now, because if we didn't do it now, they'd build so many missiles and so many drones. In a year, it would be impossible for us to prevent them from having a nuclear bomb. They would the cost to take them down, it would be like trying to take down North Korea, which already has nukes. You just can't run the risk if they decide to go to nukes. Well, I think China is increasingly being put in a position where if they tried to invade Taiwan, they couldn't accept the consequences. I mean, if America is in control of the Strait of Hormuz, if America has been cutting off their oil for months or years, and all the oil in China has to come from outside China, they don't drill any of it there. We again have a noose around China's neck. I think Trump is creating a situation where we don't have to rely on China's good graces not to invade Taiwan. We make it impracticable for them to do it. Hmm.
Yeah, I've sort of been focusing mainly on just the you know, states that are actively involved, Iran, Israel, and America at this point. Why do you think we're not seeing more action from China? Just what you're saying, or do you think they're helping Iran behind the scenes a little bit more than we know?
Well, if they're doing it, they're doing it behind the scenes, because all they've done so far is write sternly written letters and beg Iran for help that Iran cannot provide them. They're begging Iran, please let the Chinese ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran doesn't control the Strait of Hormuz anymore. There's other players in the game now that control which merchant ships come through those waters. It's not up to Iran. And you know, China had ambassadors meeting with Maduro the day Maduro was nabbed out of Venezuela, excuse me. And what did they do about that? Nothing. They did nothing. Now, their other great oil supplier, Iran, is effectively neutralized and being not so slowly degraded by the United States military. And what's China doing about that? Nothing. They're doing nothing, because I don't think they have any practicable options for what they could do that wouldn't make the situation worse for them.
Yeah, see, as I'm looking forward, I'm like, I don't see the situation getting better for anybody. Because, I mean, we're so tied in with China economically anyway. I mean, any damage we're doing to them, we're also experiencing. Europe is also experiencing this damage, right? I mean, what would be the positive outcome?
Well, who cares about Europe?
Well,
I don't care about Europe.
Well, no,
I mean, for sure, Europe gets a lot of trade through the Strait of Hormuz. China gets an enormous share of trade through the Strait of Hormuz. So, and we get a little bit. Yeah, we're going to take some hits off this too. But the hits that China is taking are orders of magnitude greater than we'll be taking. America, for example, we float on oil. If you look at an oil map of the United States, it's almost everywhere under the country. That's not China. China is the negative photograph of that. They have no oil. They've already announced that, you know, they do refine oil, crude that they import, and then they'll export the refined gasoline and diesel. They stopped that. They stopped all exportation of any refined products. They're keeping it for themselves. They have maybe a couple of weeks of, you know, normal supply, then a couple of weeks of kind of half operational supply, and then they're out of oil.
Yeah, that's going to get – it's. I mean, things are going to get crazy pretty quick, right? Like, how long can this, you know, conflict in the Strait of Hormuz even be shut down and the world economy not enter into a catastrophic death spiral? Again, I see what you're saying. I get exactly what you're saying. I think you're right. When it comes to the calculus, China has a much shorter, you know, tolerance they're able to expend. But, I mean – are we just burning down the world economy? Like, how much harder is it going to be to restart all of this? Because, I mean, Qatar is shutting down all of their liquid natural gas production. They're shutting down factories that take like 12 months to restart again. So, I mean, is this worth it? Or, I mean, how's that calculus play out if so much damage is being done to so many industries in so many countries? Is China really suffering that much that it makes it all worth it?
Does it make it all worth it? Does it make it worth it not to have the boot of China on the world's neck anymore? I mean, I don't know. There's nothing that comes without risk, right? This could go completely bad. The entire world economy could freeze up. We could have a Great Depression on a global scale. That's all possible here. But there is no victory without risk. And Trump is the president who's taking these risks. The risks are real, but it's almost like if your family's threatened by some bad actor. So you pull out a gun and you say, stay back. I'm prepared to defend myself and my family. You don't really want to have to kill that guy. You hope it doesn't get to that point. You're hoping presenting the gun will give him a clearer view of what his practical options are and that he'll choose wisely. I think that's what Trump is doing. Now, is it possible you might have to shoot that guy? Is it possible he might pull out a gun and shoot you? That's all possible. But what's the alternative? Is the alternative not to defend yourself and your family? I don't think that's, I think that's what all the presidents preceding Trump for my entire political life have been doing. And where's that gotten us? I don't think it's improved America's situation. I think it's improved China's situation.
Well, yeah, China's certainly, benefited from American foreign policy over the last several decades, which again is to me the frustrating part of, even if all this stuff is predicated on our opposition to China, it's like, well, you're the people that sold us out to China over the last 70 years. So, you know, this is sort of causing the problem and then providing the solution. So what would be an ideal outcome, do you think, for Trump? Because as far as I can tell, it looks like we're going for just straight up like failed state in Iran. We don't have anybody ready to take it over. Maybe the Kurds will take a section. I mean, but we're just talking factionalism, chaos. I mean, is that a positive outcome for the Trump administration? I guess that would put a damper on the Belt and Road operation. But again, at what cost? What do you think the question is, what do you think the best outcome would be from Trump's point of view?
Well, I mean, we may see the Kurds take some territory of Iran. I certainly wouldn't have any objection to that. A degraded Iran, I think, is largely in America's interest. We don't want it to implode. I don't think that's in anybody's interest. But the son of the former Shah is, there's a real challenge in Iran, right? So it's been run by this theocracy for decades. It's not like there's a recent outcast normal government that could just step in and take over. Right. The people who would be the apparently obvious alternatives to the theocracy, they've never run a government. They've never been judges. They've never been legislators. They've never been any of the things you need to function a government. Now, they did release some statements in the last few weeks saying, hey, we've been spending years working with experts to basically plan out how to run a government. We've been training. We've been practicing for that. And if that's the case, they may be able to step in with some foundational backing of America and put something together that looks like a working government. I don't know. That's one of the risks that we take. But is it better than having the apocalyptical theocracy? I mean, if there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind that if Iran got nuclear weapons, they would use them. They believe the future lies in an apocalypse from which their religious salvation comes. It's very difficult to sit back and say, well, let's let them get the nukes and see what happens.
See, I think I have a different view of this because it seems to me like our motivation is largely apocalyptical, and the way that Lindsey Graham and I mean all of the leadership in America, certainly the evangelical leadership, and of course you have Benjamin Netanyahu and all the Israelis talking about Purim and the rebuilding of the temple. Now we've got the temple patches on the Israeli soldiers' arms. I mean that all is about apocalypse and Armageddon. So, I mean, I don't know. To me, it seems like the Israeli side is the one that is driving us towards some sort of prophesized, great last battle. I guess they can be partners in this, right?
I mean, Israel has nukes, right? America has nukes. I mean, if we wanted to start a nuclear war for apocalyptic purposes, we're free to do that. We haven't done that.
We have not done that yet. I don't know. What do you think the odds are that we move in that direction? I mean, I'm just trying to play out like where this goes from here. I can't help but see a Vietnam style quagmire, sunk cost fallacy at a certain point. Again, I don't see what we're doing in Iran as being part of a wider strategically valid operation going on. It seems like we're flying by the seat of our pants. And kind of retroactively trying to justify it by invoking prophecies and the apocalypse. So again, I would kind of rather have a government that you could negotiate with in Iran than just a chaos of murdering ethnic tribes, right?
But could we negotiate with the theocracy? I mean, my sense is we've been trying to do that for decades without much effect.
Well, we did have deals before, and again, it seems like they were willing to meet us when it came to nukes, but then we wanted them to give up their ballistic missiles. I mean, if I was them, I wouldn't give up my ballistic missiles, because from their perspective, it's very much the same, right? The idea of somebody breaks into your house with a gun to kill your family. I mean, they're also looking at somebody holding a gun to them. So, you know, where do you think this goes from here? Because again, I'm just seeing visions of Ukraine 2.0, Vietnam 2.0. I mean, this is a disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Well, were they willing to meet us on nukes? I mean, that's not my sense from the reporting. My sense is just days before these combative activities began, they were telling our representatives, American representatives, no, we're still determined to have a nuclear bomb. We even offered them non-nuclear grade fissionable material for energy purposes. And they said, no, that's not good enough. We're going to have a nuclear bomb. We're determined to have that. Well, so I don't think that's kind of meeting us in the middle.
Well, I'm not sure what the final, you know, well, obviously the final outcome of the talks was that they failed. But, you know, there'd been differing reports about what had been decided. But we'd scheduled another, you know, round of talks in Geneva, right? So, you know, we were talking with them, and it appears as though we were making progress in one way or another. Tehran is ready for nuclear concessions if U.S. meets demands, Iranian officials say. So, again, you know, to me, it's like, all right, here are these people that were at least willing to talk to us that we'd had an agreement with back in 2015 that they had been sticking to as far as the observers from the IAEA had recognized. So again, I don't see how this benefits America at the end of the day. Maybe it hurts China, but I just see this as going to be another $1 trillion dune boggle, right? I mean, what's the positive outcome here?
Well, the positive outcome would be we have a rational government in Iran. Now, whether or not we get there remains to be seen. I don't see this as anything like the Vietnam morass or even the prior Gulf War morasses. We're not landing troops. We're not attempting to make them into a democracy ourselves. I mean, the way Marco Rubio talks about it, it would be great if they went that way, but that's going to be for them to have to do. In Vietnam, it was the whole environment was different. The weapons we could bring to bear were different. The enemy was in a jungle. It was very difficult. They had no real infrastructure to attack. Now in Iran, the moment they fire a missile, the infrared signals detected from space, and we're dropping GPS bombs on those locations within seconds of things being fired. So we're able to degrade Iran's military and ability in a way we were never able to practically do in Vietnam. So it's a completely different scenario from that perspective. Listen, if we start landing troops to occupy Iran, I'll be the first person to say that's going to be a hellscape, and we should absolutely not be doing that. I would favor impeaching any president who would do that, including Trump, but I don't see that happening. So that's not a major concern of mine.
Well, then, but don't we have to land troops? I mean, the only other option is bombing campaigns, aerial raids, and they've been doing that in Gaza. Gaza is a 25-mile square, you know, landlocked open-air prison, and they still haven't defeated Hamas. So yeah, when you talk about Iran, you're talking about 90 million people, area the size two times of Texas. I mean, it's not jungles, but it's equally as difficult terrain, right? So, but we can't.
Yeah, I don't think you can claim victory over a territory from the air. I don't think that's possible. As you say, we haven't done it in Hamas either. But what you can do from the air is degrade that political nation state to a degree that it's no longer an imminent threat to your own nation. Hamas doesn't have nukes. I think we can prevent Iran from having that too. And hopefully prime an environment in which rational people will take over the governance of that nation state of Iran. But in the meantime, they're not becoming increasingly closer to being an existential threat to the United States.
See, I just don't know if I haven't seen any evidence that they're, you know, an existential threat to the United States. I've seen that they're an existential threat to Israel, maybe. But I mean, where do you think that dividing line is? It seems to me like The thing that we're getting here is freedom of action.
I mean, they shout death to America at every opportunity, right? I mean, they proclaim it.
Yes.
They don't proclaim peaceful intentions to America. They're quite the opposite.
I would, too, if I was them.
Well, I understand. Listen, from their moral position, maybe that's an appropriate thing to shout is death to America. But as an American, I'm very concerned about people who shout that they're advocating for my death, securing nuclear weapons. That, to me, as an American, that's a bad plan.
See, I guess I'm more concerned about not doing the thing that makes us enemies overseas. Because, again, like how would it come about that a rational, you know, freedom-loving power structure takes over Iran? I mean, that's just not going to happen. I mean, I guess that could happen in Gaza too, but like, it's not gonna. So why?
Well, I don't care if it's freedom loving. I just care that it's not a threat to my nation. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be a dictatorship that's not a threat to America, well, that's fine. They can govern themselves as they think best. I'll leave that up to them. I don't think they need to fly the American flag and have bald eagles and do all that kind of stuff. I just want them not to be a threat to my nation. However they organize themselves consistent with that mandate is up to them.
Okay. I mean, I feel like they're a bigger threat to our nation now than they were last week around this time, right?
I would say no. I mean, their air force is obliterated. Their navy is obliterated. Their nuclear capability as it was developing is obliterated. I don't think they're stronger now than they were a week ago.
Well, no, not that they're stronger, that America is under. I mean, a week ago, we still had our base in Bahrain, right? So, again, it's like starting this conflict, starting this fight just doesn't seem well advised to me. It seems like we were talking with them. I don't think they were an imminent threat. I mean, none of their missiles can hit us. They could potentially, you know, get nuclear weapons. I don't know if that's been degraded at this point. It seems like the best way to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons is to get them to agree to the IAEA inspections, so, you know, to keep a handle on their operations. But obviously that's not going to happen anytime soon. It seems like the belligerence with which we approach this issue has made the whole thing, you know, untenable and significantly more dangerous.
And I understand your perspective, and a lot of people obviously agree with that perspective. My view is just different. I don't see us as having provoked this confrontation with Iran. That's just not my view of events. Maybe it's just because I'm a substantially older guy than you are. But I remember when Iran took our hostages in 1979. I remember the decade after decade after decade, and Iran either directly or through proxies attacking American interests. This has been a fight that's been ongoing for many, many, many years. It's not something that just happened. We have a different president now, and the president decided, listen, we've been talking for a while. You have to judge people by their actions more than their words. He lost confidence that they were speaking with us, negotiating with us in good faith. He believed they were increasingly becoming a threat that would be impossible to practically defeat. In a year or so, he decided to act now. I don't think that's an insane decision. We can disagree with the policy. We can disagree with how we view Iran and its relationships with America and what we think might have happened if we'd gone a different way. But I don't see this as an insane policy position for the president to have taken. Very aggressive, for sure.
Well, yeah, and I would like to see some, you know, more well explained outcome of this, like desired outcome. Because so far, I haven't seen anything expressed that could be like, here's what we want. I mean, at least when we went to Iraq, it was like, we're going to bring them democracy. And it was stupid. I was against it then. Right. But at least it was an excuse. Andrew Branca is my guest. More on the other side. I'm really enjoying this conversation. You don't get a lot of back and forths like this about these very contentious topics. But he's a very smart guy. We'll be right back.
I'm making this announcement on Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. You have until the 17th of March to take advantage of the March mega sale at thealexjonesstore.com. This is one of the biggest sales of the year yet. Up to 40% off store-wide. 25% off on the shirts, on the hats. 10% off on things like the collectible knives. And up to 40% off on supplements like Ultramethylene Blue. And the more you buy, the more you save. These are incredible products. You've seen the rave reviews. You've seen the five-star reviews. These are the very best game-changing supplements available, period. Again, I only sell things that really work because I want you to get them and I want you to love them. We now have an over 90% reorder on the supplements on the site. No one in that industry has it because the products are so good, and obviously you're loyal as well. And I thank you so much for keeping us on the air. We're changing the world. We're battling the globalists. We are having the greatest effect together. That's all of us against the new world order we've ever had. And it's all because of your support of my broadcast and other broadcasts like it. But regardless, the enemy recognizes that InfoWars is the tip of the spear. And the bad guys are continuing, just read the newspapers, try to shut us down as early as late March. We're battling them in court, but it looks like this could be the end. But that's okay, because the info war belongs to the people. The info war is about telling the truth and countering the lies of the globalist. And the AlexJonesStore.com is not owned by me. It's owned by Bigler. The backup Alex Jones Network that's ready is not owned by me. It's owned by them, and I'm going to work for them. And so as long as you support the sponsor, no matter what happens to InfoWars, TheAlexJonesStore.com, you keep us on the air. So right now, your purchase at TheAlexJonesStore.com keeps InfoWars going, pays the payroll, the bandwidth, the satellites, all of it. But as soon as InfoWars shuts down, it's more critical than ever that you support TheAlexJonesStore.com because it will move forward into the future as our main sponsor. But regardless, this is a win-win. Has InfoWars not delivered? In Gladiator, he chops up the first four guys when they throw him in the ring, or you know, in the arena, and he says, "Are you not entertained?
Are you not entertained?"
Well, I would say to you, are you not satisfied? Have we not delivered in the fight against the globalists? You bet on the right horse, and I'm asking you to continue to bet on us as the info war continues on, regardless, as we refuse to submit to the tyrants. But the reason this is such a win-win or a non-zero-sum game or a 360 win, the term I coined over a decade ago, is because everybody participating supports freedom, supports the fight against tyrants, the fight for team humanity, against the globalist, and you get incredible products at the same time. So if you haven't tried ultramethylene blue or our bovine colostrum or our CMOS or our Shilajit, these are all incredible products available right now at thealexjonesstore.com. And if you're going to buy anything on the site, you should become a VIP for $30 a month, cancel any time for free, and instantly $40 is put in your account. The second you click in a VIP, when it recurs each month, instantly $40 goes in, so you make $10 to spend on top of the $30 you spend. Special deals, special offers, and with one click in your profile, you cancel any time for free. So it's a very light commitment, and you get special deals on top of everything else. So anybody buying anything on thealexjonesstore.com should be a VIP, so make sure you do that. So take advantage of the March Mega Sale right now, running until the 17th at thealexjonesstore.com, and be the reason we'll always stay on the air. Again, I salute you and thank you. Take action now.
Methylene blue, it is tremendous. I would not be making this video if I didn't believe in it. After I take it throughout the day, I start feeling better and better and better. My workouts, I feel like I'm 15 years younger than I am, and the app that I record my running on proves that my workouts are getting better. So I gotta tell you what, God, family, country, InfoWars, and methylene blue. Get it while you can.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the War Room. And by the way, let me tell you right now, there's the March Mega Sale that's on at thealexjonesstore.com. Of course, the only way that we get funding, we do not have advertisers, we do not have corporate sponsors, we do not have billionaires giving us their inheritance money. No, all we have is you, the American people, when you go to thealexjonesstore.com. Get yourself a fantastic product at a great price. So really, it's a win-win-win-win situation. You win by getting a fantastic product and supporting the info war. We win by continuing to be able to tell the truth and have the great discussions that we have with our incredible guests, like my guest, Andrew F. Branca. You can follow him on X at The Branca Show and YouTube.com/The Branca Show. And we're talking the Iran war. And I got to be honest, Mr. Branca, I didn't expect you to be as in favor of it as you are. I don't want to put words in your mouth. And strictly because I feel like we're fairly aligned on pretty much everything I ever see you talk about. I think you hit the nail on the head. So I'm just kind of confused on how we're misaligned here. And you know, I don't want to be wrong, and I'm not certain I'm right. So I'm happy to have this conversation. I guess to me, it's like one of the things. I think last time you were on, we were talking a lot about immigration and the flood of Indians and stuff like this. I mean, is that not going to be a downstream effect? I'm worried about the 90 million potential refugees. If we just create a failed state, how many of them are going to go to Europe? How many of them are going to continue on to America? I mean, isn't this going to cause a lot of downstream problems that you're concerned about?
I mean, what Europe does is Europe's problem. I don't care what they do. America should not be allowing not only no asylum in America, no refugees in America. We shouldn't be allowing any third world immigration into America at all. That's a decision we get to make. The asylums don't force their way into our nation. We can close our borders. We've demonstrated that. If we choose to let more third worlders into our nation, well, we've just decided to make our nation more like the third world. I think that would be a bad policy. But the fact that we're acting outside in the world doesn't mean we have to allow tens of millions of asylum seekers in. Those are different decisions.
I suppose that's true. I still don't like the creation of the conditions that brings about the, because at the end of the day, I guess that's my thing, is I'm like, okay, maybe Iran ends up being less of a threat than it used to be, but like compared to everything we have to deal with here, it's just the disconnect between what we have to deal with here and what's going on in Iran. Like, maybe if we go to war with Iran after we somehow created conditions here in America where we don't have any more refugees, maybe if we controlled our immigration system and had deported everybody, then after we get done with that, we can go take care of Iran, knowing that the refugees aren't going to be a problem. But you know what I mean? I just feel like this is not the time to be dealing with this stuff with Iran when we have all this other stuff going on.
I guess my response would be, we don't live in a perfect world where we get to solve our problems one by one in their entirety before we proceed on to the next problem. The world's complicated. There's lots of spinning plates. There's lots of things that are broken. I noticed when I was waiting to come in originally in the green room, you were the show was talking about payoffs for legislatures that had done bad things with children. That's horrific. I'm the father of four children. I think anybody that harms children should be buried under the jail. Yep. But we can't say, let's solve that problem before we deal with the immigration problem, before we deal with the tariff problem, before we deal with the Iran problem. The world doesn't allow you. It's not like an old school karate movie where the bad guys come at you one at a time and you get to defeat them one at a time. Right. It's more complicated than that. And if you ask the Trump administration, they would say, and again, I'm not inside the Trump administration. I don't know exactly their thinking. All I can go by is what they tell us. They say they felt they could no longer afford to wait. They didn't have the luxury of further patience because of the scale at which Iran was building its offensive missile and nuclear capabilities relative to our ability to build defensive measures against them. If we did not intervene now, it would be too late. Maybe they're lying. Maybe they're making it up. But maybe they're telling the truth.
Yeah, I mean, they could be. Because from my interpretation, I think they're just kind of throwing anything at the wall to see what sticks. I mean, Marco Rubio said, well, they were going to attack, or Israel was going to attack, so we had to attack because we were going to get it. I mean, it gets complicated and circular at a certain point. But, again, I get the impression that none of this was well planned. I mean, now we're asking the Kurds to get involved. That seemed like an afterthought, like we didn't know we were going to need something like that. I mean, tell me, because my interpretation is that he thought this was going to be like Venezuela. I was against Venezuela. I'm happy to admit that the Venezuela operation was a magnificent success. Even though I was against it, even though I would go back in time, I wouldn't say to do it. It was great. It worked really well. Nobody on our side died. Like, boom, done. If that had been what happened to Iran, I probably wouldn't have much to say right now. It seems to me like that's what they thought was going to happen, and they did not expect the situation we're now in. Do you disagree with that?
I think I would, because in Venezuela, we went in with one particular mission to seize one person, Maduro. We did that, and that was the end of the operation, the military operation. That wasn't our mission in Iran. Iran, it was to decapitate their leadership structure and to degrade their ballistic missile, their drone capabilities. That can't happen in a weekend. I think they knew from the beginning it was going to take at least weeks for that to happen. Trump says 4 weeks. But, like it's any kind of fight, anytime you're in a fight, even if it's a pretend fight, like you train martial arts, I do BJJ. When you start wrestling with someone, you don't know how it's going to end exactly at the end. Even if you know you're better than them and you're overwhelmingly likely to win, you don't know what all the intervening moves are going to be. You have to respond to the things they do in response to your actions. So there's a certain shake-the-box element to this. There's a certain uncertainty in the step-by-step progression. And at each step, almost like a chess game, what you're hoping to do is make the best move based on the information you have in that moment, and then you see how things develop, and then you make the next best move. But you can't predict from the start of a chess game exactly where all the pieces are going to be at the end. You just have to take it step by step and hope to advantage your position at each move.
Right. Certainly that's true. I get the sense that, you know, maybe they thought if we take out the Ayatollah, then, you know, they'll want to negotiate. Because it seems to me...
Well, isn't that true, though? I mean, I've seen reports that now they're trying to negotiate.
Well, I've seen the opposite. Because there was a report that Trump asked for a ceasefire and the Iranians said no. Because, you know, and maybe they're not rational actors in this, but, like, that's one of the things, right? You know, it's like in a fight, you think, okay, I'll just, you know, run up and sucker punch this person and knock him out. And it's like, but what if they don't get knocked out? What if they just turn around and now you're in the fight? And now it's like, you can't just back off. You can't go, oh, well, we tried and it didn't work, especially because we see the way that they're pounding Israel right now, which, again, I mean, this is another wrinkle to it, right? Is if this was all in totally like being orchestrated by Israel, they're kind of getting their butts kicked. I mean, Ben Gurion Airport's on fire right now. So, I mean, how does that play into it? But it seems like Iran just sort of has this irrational, like, you know what? We're not even going to, like, it's a fight to the death now. And so now, like, we're in it. We can't just back out or else Israel gets totally destroyed. So it's like now we're in it, one, you know, to the end. And what the end looks like is sort of ugly no matter what the outcome is. So I think we got in over our heads.
Maybe. I don't see it that way because it doesn't look incoherent to me. And if we were just spasmodically responding to things that totally surprise us, I think it would be a lot more incoherent. As far as Israel, listen, I mentioned earlier, if Europe makes bad immigration decisions and decides to accept tens of millions of Iranian asylum seekers, I don't care what happens to them from their own bad decisions. It doesn't mean I want harm to Europe. I don't have any animosity towards them, but if they make bad decisions, that's a them problem. And I feel the same way about Israel. I don't wish any ill on Israel, but if Israel makes decisions and they turn out to have bad consequences for Israel, that's an Israel problem. That's not my problem.
I agree, but they are becoming bad situations for us, right? I mean, we wouldn't even be in this situation as it stands now, let alone, you know, where we were last week, if it weren't for, you know, Israel's actions in Gaza and our unwillingness to restrain them there. So to me, it seems like this is being motivated by Israel. It seems to me like Israel is seeing this as their sort of last chance to take out Iran, which obviously they've harbored a desire to do that for 40 years. And they're seeing their PR collapse overseas. They know that the younger generation is not going to have the same support for Israel that they do now. So they need to become hegemonic and uncontested in the Middle East. So that seems to be the motivation, as far as I can tell. I don't see America benefiting
from this. The motivation
for
who? For America?
Yeah, for America too.
The motivation for America?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I mean, that could be. But I see an American motivation that doesn't require that it be driven by Israel. I mean, what the administration has been saying is we made a decision to decapitate their leadership structure, degrade their ability to employ ICBMs and drones against America, against our interests, against the Strait of Hormuz, against Europe. Their ICBM certainly can reach our NATO allies in Europe. Those are all American interests that have nothing to do with Israel. So does Israel play a role here? I would expect so. They're another American ally. All of this would not happen but for Israel. I see a coherent rationale for America to pursue this path in its own national interest that doesn't require our decision-making being driven by Israel.
Well, I mean, to me, it seems like, I guess you can make that argument. To me, it's not sufficient to actually justify the attack itself. But like maybe retroactively or retrospectively, you could say, well, we can benefit from this. But I don't see the risk versus reward equation coming out on the reward side personally, just because we could be here literally 20 years from now in the exact same quagmire, having spent $1 trillion, right? I mean, what's the difference that you see between how we're entering Iran right now and how we entered Iraq back in 2003?
Sent in a ton of troops. We sent in ground troops. That's the difference. Again, as I said earlier, if we send any substantive numbers of ground troops, you know, anything beyond like embassy protection Marines, you know, not zero, because sometimes you have to have a few troops there. But to actually occupy and secure and seize and control ground, substantive ground in Iran, I'd be absolutely against it. That should not happen. That's a bad plan. It was a bad plan the last 18 times we did it. It would be a bad plan now. But we're not doing that. So that's what I think the distinction is.
So that I guess is where I'm confused, because it's like, if you don't put troops on the ground, then what are you doing? I mean, again, as I'm playing out the different options, it's like, okay, if you don't put troops on the ground, that does away with any possibility of a, you know, occupied peace or anything like that. All you have then is the air battle, in which case, you know, we're back to Libya or Syria or any of these other like failed states that, you know, it's just sort of, we routinely have to pop up and crush whatever terrorist organization, you know, manages to cobble itself together in the ashes. Again, it's just like, what if we don't put troops on the ground? Like, what's the final outcome?
Well, first of all, I think we are degrading Iran's ICBM and drone capability, its threat capacity against the Strait of Hormuz, which is very important to world trade. I think that's worth doing in and of itself. But we're also shaking the box. Now, it's like a game of pieces, right? You shake the box and you open up the box and you got to put the pieces back together from an unpredictable pattern. There's a chaos element here. What we are doing is we're priming an environment in which the Ayatollah's gone. Most of its senior leadership is gone. Who's going to step into that vacuum? I don't know, but somebody will. There's a prospect. They're better for us, for America's interests, than the Ayatollah was. Could they be worse? Could they be worse than people spending decades threatening death to America, attempting everything in their power to secure nuclear arms, having a theocratic apocalyptic view of what the world should look like? I think it would be hard to get much worse than what was there before. So we've removed that. I'm not sure what we're going to get. I don't think the administration is sure what we're going to get, but I think we're hopeful we'll get something that's better. If that's not the case, we'll have to address that situation when it arises.
Well, the Ayatollah had a fatwa against nuclear weapons previously. I mean, there's no guarantee that the next one will be similarly inclined. But like, how does this play into things like Lebanon? I mean, they just told, you know, a million people to get out of Lebanon. You've got the and it's not Naftali Bennett. It's Smotrich going out and saying we're going to turn this neighborhood of Beirut into the new Khan Yunis. They're going to give it the Gaza treatment. I mean, the arguments about Iran being a threat to America, I mean, Lebanon, it's not a threat to America in any significant way, really. I mean, except for the stay-behind networks that could potentially exist here. But again, those are going to...
America's threatening to bomb Lebanon?
Well, we have used our pressure to get the Lebanese government to try to disarm Hezbollah and to give up a large portion of their, you know, sovereign land to Israel.
So I think maybe one driver of the apparent disconnect between us is not one of merit. It's one of perspective. Mm-hmm. So you obviously have a much better informed, a much broader perspective and view of things happening in the Middle East than I do. My view is much narrower. That doesn't mean it's better, but that could explain why we approach this problem from different directions. My entirely focus is Middle East. I just don't care what they do with themselves. I don't care what Lebanon does to Israel. I don't care what Israel does to Lebanon. It doesn't matter to me. I wish they would fix themselves and live in peace and not have people dying and murdering and killing and suffering all the time. That would be my preference. But I don't have any control over that. That's for them to determine their destiny and their part of the world. I only care about what happens in the Middle East to the extent that it becomes a threat to my nation.
Well, and
then I want that threat neutralized.
Absolutely. And that's where we definitely overlap, because the reason I'm so concerned about what's going on in the Middle East is because I do see how it informs and affects how we do things here. And I think obviously one of the big problems I've seen illustrated over the last couple of years, but especially in the last week, is the fact that there are a lot of people in America who seem to be making decisions on the basis of what's good for Israel. I mean, I think that's a major issue. And again, I just wonder if these decisions are even being made with our interest in mind.
You should have Ben Shapiro on the show. I'm sure that's his perspective, I would imagine. It's not my perspective, though. I don't speak in defense of Israel. I think Israel, like any nation, is going to pursue its own national interest. I think that's appropriate for any nation to do, but it's not of concern to me. And if they, again, if they make bad decisions that have bad consequences for them, that's on Israel to deal with.
Yeah, no, but I'm talking about when that affects American behavior and and the way American power is expressed. Yeah. Because to me, I don't care, what Israel wants to do, except that there's a bunch of Israelis here that are going to, rope us along with them, right? I would prefer we don't have that. How do we solve that problem? Because then you don't have to care and I don't have to care. Neither one of us can, have to care about the Middle East if they didn't drag their issues over here.
Yeah, so, I mean, American politics is messy, right? There's a lot of drivers of American politics. Israel, I expect, is among maybe the most powerful of those. Often it's difficult to see what the drivers are and how they're working because these are backdoor arrangements. I'm not suggesting that doesn't exist. I presume that does exist. All our NATO allies do this. Every nation, again, is acting in its own national interest or going to influence the U.S. in their national interest to the greatest extent possible. Maybe Israel's exceptionally good at that and good at making America act counter to our own interest because it's favorable to Israel. I'm amenable to that argument. The solution to that is to have different politicians. The solution to that is get rid of people who are amenable to that kind of corruption, whether it's from Israel or any other nation, and replace them with people who are less amenable to that kind of corruption. This applies to the legislatures who are using our tax money to pay off people that they've harassed in a variety of ways. It applies to our politicians who flood our nation with third world migrants, tens of millions of them who will never assimilate, never be Americans. All they do is make America less America. These are all terrible things that are happening. And the reason they're happening is because of the politicians we have. Frankly, I see in the Trump administration really the only avenue to have a hope of saving America. It doesn't mean I have to agree with everything Trump does. I certainly don't. But the Democrats are against our national interest. They're progressive fascists. They want to rule over us like a bunch of kings over a third world feudal society. The Republicans, the classic Republican Party, these are the John Thunes, the Cornyns in Texas. These are just rhinos. They don't really have America's interest at heart either. They have their own wallets at heart. They're happy to be loyal opposition to the Democrats, getting rich at the trough, never having to be in responsibility, never having to make hard decisions that might potentially have negative consequences for which they would have to take the heat. And then you have what's effectively a kind of third party. Now, third parties don't work in America. They've never worked, not since Ross Perot or any other time. But Trump has effectively launched a MAGA party, an American First Party, that is taking over the Republican Party. It's a slow process. It's a slow process because of the inherent nature of our governmental structure. You can only replace a congressman every 2 years, and the reelection rate's like 90-95%. They're very difficult to unseat an incumbent. You only have a shot at a senator every 6 years, president every 4 years. Federal judges never, never, unless we get enough seats in the Senate to start throwing some of these federal judges out, which, God willing, will happen sometime in my lifetime. That would be enormous. But it takes a long time to change these people out. I see that happening in the Trump administration. I see better people coming in, replacing rhinos, displacing Democrats. And that's really my hope for the future. That's why I'm not a black pillar. It doesn't mean Trump's not going to make bad decisions. He does. It doesn't mean he's not going to make bad endorsements. He does. Nobody's perfect. Trump's not perfect either. But I try to look at these things directionally. Is the overall mass of direction, effort, inertia of direction, moving where I want to see America move. And I have to say, I do see it doing that.
Well, I do too, in terms of the long-term view. That you're definitely right, as in, like, eventually the people that are in office now are going to die out and younger people are going to move in and they're going to be much more aligned with the MAGA, Trump vision of things. But it seems like that's the long-term, like, tidal shift going on. But in the meantime, there's this constant back-and-forth battle where it seems to me like most of the good people from the Trump administration are not able to get what they need done. They're being pressured out. And the swamp is just like, you know, latching onto him and pulling him in slowly. I mean, the fact that he's like best friends with Lindsey Graham now. So there's this like short term kind of like infection from the swamp taking over MAGA. But over the long term, I think you're right that the groundswell impetus is certainly on the side of the not neocon, the nationalistic, youthful MAGA Americans. Is it going to happen fast enough? Like, I guess this is a race against time at this point.
Well, first of all, I have to say I completely agree on Lindsey Graham. I scream at my computer every time I see Trump standing next to Lindsey Graham. It drives me crazy. But that's not a new friendship. That's not the swamp coming in. He's always been in orbit around Trump. The change I see happening is tends to be change in a good direction for America. I think Pete Hegseth is enormously better as Secretary of War than anybody we had under Biden or Obama or the Bushes, for that matter. I think Marco Rubio, who I didn't think much of as a senator from Florida, I think is just a tremendous, tremendous secretary. Whether you agree with his decisions or not, even if you disagree with him, you can't disagree with the expertise he's bringing to that office. He does what he's doing with great proficiency. Lindsey Graham, I will not be sad the day Lindsey Graham walks off the political stage for the last time. But the changes I'm seeing happen are changes in the right direction. And to me, that's very encouraging. I've never seen anything like it before. And the first president I ever voted for was Reagan. So I've been around a hot minute watching this stuff. And I really have hope for the future of America for the first time. And I'm far more than I had under Trump's first term, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've been trying to cling on to that hope. It's been a disappointing year for me, Bronco. I mean, we're not getting any deportations. It's like it seems like things are falling off. Again, I agree that and the trajectory and certainly the will of the American people is absolutely going in the right direction. It's just that it's the two-party system and the entrenched Republican interests that are really talented at exerting their priorities over the American people, but hopefully we can continue.
The judges are a real problem. The yes. Federal judges are a real problem. But again, we just had, was it yesterday? Just yesterday, a unanimous Supreme Court decision that checked the authority of the unelected, black-robed, tyrannical federal district trial court judges to impede deportations on asylum claims. I mean, again, that's another step in the right direction. But it is a war. America is in an existential war for survival. In any war, you're going to have wins and you're going to have losses. And what you're hoping for is you have more wins than you do losses. But the losses are going to come too. And we can't despair every time one of those happens, as long as we're moving directionally in the right movement.
I just want to stomp my enemies into the dirt. I don't want to lose. I want to win. But absolutely, I understand. This has been a surprisingly white-pilling conversation. Thank you very much. Andrew F. Bronco has been my guest at The Bronco Show on X, on YouTube as well, at The Bronco Show. When do you air? Daily?
Yeah, pretty much every day, 11 a.m. Eastern time. I live stream on YouTube, X, and Rumble.
There you go, 11 a.m. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thanks, man. Take care.
You too. All right, folks, we'll see you tomorrow. This has been The War Room. Go to thealexjonesstore.com to support us. It's the only way that we'll be here to have these types of conversations, talk about these types of topics. See you tomorrow.
As InfoWars not delivered. In Gladiator, he chops up the first four guys when they throw him in the ring, or in the arena, and he says, "Are you not entertained?
Are you not entertained?"
Well, I would say to you, are you not satisfied? Have we not delivered in the fight against the globalists? You bet on the right horse, and I'm asking you to continue to bet on us as the InfoWar continues on, regardless, as we refuse to submit to the tyrants. But the reason this is such a win-win or a non-zero-sum game or a 360 win, the term I coined over a decade ago, is because everybody participating supports freedom, supports the fight against tyrants, the fight for team humanity, against the globalists, and you get incredible products at the same time. So if you haven't tried ultramethylene blue or our bovine colostrum or our CMOS or our Shilajit, these are all incredible products available right now at thealexjonesstore.com. And if you're going to buy anything on the site, you can become a VIP for $30 a month, cancel any time for free, and instantly $40 is put in your account. The second you click in a VIP, when it recurs each month, instantly $40 goes in. So you make $10 to spend on top of the $30 you spend. Special deals, special offers, and with one click in your profile, you cancel anytime for free. So it's a very light commitment, and you get special deals on everything else. So anybody buying anything on thealexhistore.com should be a VIP, so make sure you do that. You have until the 17th of March to take advantage of the March mega sale at thealexjonesstore.com. This is one of the biggest sales of the year yet, up to 40% off store-wide, 25% off on the shirts, on the hats, 10% off on things like the collectible knives, and up to 40% off on supplements like ultramethylene blue. And the more you buy, the more you save. So take advantage of the March mega sale right now, running until the 17th at thealexjonesstore.com, and be the reason we'll always stay on the air. I'm going to salute you and thank you. Take action now.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.